Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hello!
Hey, Shireen, this is Ethnically Ambiguous. This is Anna.
This is Shireen, and this episode is so special. I really think everyone will really like it, and I encourage you all to share it with everyone you know. We have Fatima for Assembly, a.k.a. Fatima Iqbal Zubair, with us today. She's a candidate in L.A. running for State Assembly for District 64, and her platform is very important. She's a grassroots candidate, and we get into what brought her into politics after being a science teacher and why her platform is so important as a Muslim woman.
Yeah, and we talk about what it's like to be a Muslim woman and the stereotypes that come with being Muslim and Islam and so much more. I think you guys will really enjoy this conversation, so stay tuned.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my parents? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Anna.
How's
calling
it going?
Anna this time, consciously. We have a very special guest today that I've been looking forward to this ever since we booked her. I admire this person so much. I'm not sure if you're outside of LA, you might not know her, and this is a perfect place for you to learn about her. Mm-hmm. The value of name and identity and representation is really important to all of us. So yeah, I'm really excited to welcome. And I guess I should have asked, I mean, I'm saying
we
how I would say
to
her
welcome.
Name. Yes, we are excited to welcome both Anna and I. Does it sound weird me calling you Anna?
No, it's
like,
fine.
Oh, okay. That's well, fine, I'm going to keep trying my best because we should use your name.
Let's give some context. So this guest, yeah, like you said, you might not know them outside of LA area. LA, I mean, just the whole LA County, if you will. But we came across them when they started their campaign for a state assembly.
Yeah. And I followed them immediately.
Yeah.
We're talking about Fatima Iqbal Zubair. Did I say your name right or wrong?
That was correct. That was perfect.
Perfect. Okay. I have a bias toward the name Fatima. My grandma's name is Fatima. I love that name. And it's very rare to see any politician with an Arabic name, let alone one that like I think is family. So I was already kind of like, who is this hijabi Muslim person? So I followed you immediately and we happened to like have the perfect cross where we have you on this podcast finally. I want to get into your name and how pivotal it is to potentially have you, if you're elected into the California legislature, you'll be the first Muslim woman ever in California legislature. And California is one of the most progressive states we have. Mm-hmm. And that is monumental. So yeah, I'm calling to bring it back to what we were talking about in the beginning. I'm calling Anna this episode because Fatima made it a point that we should honor Anna's name. And I really appreciate that. So I'm trying my best.
Yeah. And just to give some more context, you're running for state assembly. And what's the district you're running for?
Yeah. So I'm running in District 64 state assembly, which is mostly South Central LA. And, you know, some of the major cities are Watts, Compton, Carson, North Long Beach, Wilmington, Willowbrook.
And yeah, you've been endorsed by the Democratic Socialists and other really progressive groups. And I want to get into all of that. I think what's essential to your background is the fact that you were a teacher. And you are, I mean, are you still a teacher or have you completely pivoted?
Yeah, no, right now I'm doing my campaign. I was teaching at the beginning of my campaign, but it's really hard. And, you know, part of this is also the privilege I have because I married and I'm not a single income household. So my husband's, you know, great enough to where I can invest myself full time in this. And he, you know, thankfully has a good job and is an engineer and able to, you know, support both of us, including my son at this time. So I was very stubborn in the beginning though, because I'm very much a feminist. And part of the reason I kept teaching was I will not depend on your income. You know what I mean? I was very much like that. But then, you know, I realized that I was just being stubborn. And, you know, my husband is very much great in that we're equal partners. And, you know, he's very, very much so not the traditional, right? Yeah. I'm not trying to stereotype, but, you know, not the traditional husband. They're both very equal, very independent in our lives. And I know he was saying that because he wanted me to focus on this part of my life. And if he was doing that in some part of his life, he'd probably want me to support him. So then once I got that in my head, I was like, okay, yes, let's focus 100% on this. One thing I am doing right now, though, is I still try to stop into some of my robotics team meetings. Not as much as I can, but I try to participate where I can. It's a team that I founded when I was in Watts.
Oh, cool.
And it's been so, I don't mean to talk about teaching my whole life, the whole time, but when you get me started to talk about teaching, I usually can't stop. But it was the hardest thing, decision actually to make. Part of it was my stubbornness and wanting to, like, you know, get my own income. And part of it was like, you know, it's really hard. I taught science. I was department chair. And part of the reason it was hard, especially as a science teacher, was my students that I taught had subs the past 2 years. And, you know, obviously I'm biased, but I think science and, you know, is a very important subject, especially getting lower income students into science. And that's part of the reason I didn't want to leave. But then I realized if I can, you know, make schools better, right, in communities like mine all over California, if I can put my all into this. And I explained it this way to my students. I said, you know, I know this is hard. You all have my contact information. You know, I still was present in school, especially during the primary, because I went for the robotics meetings and all that, and they saw me. But they understood that I'm doing this to kind of make it better for generations to come, not just, you know, for them. It's beyond them. It's for the community. It's for the state. And so I think they understood that. At least I pray that they did, because it was very hard for me to leave. I felt, you know, so much at peace in the classroom. It was what I loved the most. But I knew this is what I had to do if I had a shot against this corporately funded Democrat who, you know, it's very hard to beat someone like that. And so I did need to put my all into this, you know.
Right. And you're all grassroots, which is amazing. It's very much needed in a time where, like, corrupt corporate capitalism rules and we're all out here being like, well, what about us?
Yeah.
The real people who hold this entire country up but get zero attention or zero support from the government, that's supposed to technically, if you think of what a government is, supposed to take care of us, but we get nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, something that's really notable, Anna, that you said is, you know, and we talked about before this interview, is that California is quote unquote known to be progressive. But in my mind, especially starting around this campaign, I mean, Bernie always talked about, you know, the United States being the richest nation, but we're actually also a really bad example of income inequality, because we actually have the most wealth in the state of any other state in the nation, the most income, but our income inequality and our wealth inequality gap is really large. So there's people that are profiting, you know, off of COVID, these corporations. But then we see, you know, homelessness getting worse all throughout the state. We see, I mean, and it's worse than anywhere else in the nation, you know. And so to me, honestly, with the amount of wealth and capacity we have to support the middle class, support students and children, we're actually doing pretty bad. If that's the metric, right? With how much we have, what are we doing? We're actually not doing as much as we can. Yeah.
I think it's really amazing to be in LA and realizing that real change has to happen for people that actually care. If you're in LA, you can probably like Nithya Raman, for example, seeing women of color come into these places of political seats after having careers because they realize there's no other option. Like, real change has to happen from us. And I really think it's very valuable for young people, especially, to see women of color, women of different religious backgrounds in places that can make change. And I think you had a point, like, with deciding to stop teaching right now.
Yeah.
Because as a politician or as someone in state assembly, you can impact the way our schools are in a larger way, because teachers are so essential and so vital, especially teachers like you that truly value your job. And, like, we can get into the whole how valuable it is to even see a woman of color in science, like, you know what I mean? That's already valuable. But I also think it's really powerful to see leaders that are, again, people with my family's name, people that are Muslim, people that are Arab, or Middle Eastern, or just women of color in general. So I really applaud you for deciding to make that pivot, because it is really difficult and it's not a sure thing. But drawing attention to the systemic changes that need to happen in order to like make our state and make our society better is worth it tenfold, in my mm-hmm. opinion. So yeah. I just can't be more obsessed with you is what I'm trying to Aww. Say.
Sure, you know, it's, I always think it's like, you know, not me, it's us. I think all stakeholders are important in this. It's you both on here sharing stories like mine and sharing stories of that aren't heard in the media. It's teachers, it's the community organizers, the activists on the streets. I really think that's the beautiful part about a thriving democracy. It really needs to be all of us. And, you know, it's really surprising. Our state is very diverse, but yet we still have more white men up there. I mean, most of the, though they're white men, there's only, you know, I think about 3 immigrants and 2 or 3 public school teachers up there. And it's still only about 30% women, which is really a large amount of women compared to other states. But it's, I definitely didn't get into this because I was Muslim or South Asian. It was more about justice for me. It was actually my faith that got me into it because, you know, a lot of it in Islam, we say that when we see something, and I'm misquoting the hadith or, you know, the scripture from this, but if we see something, it's actually part of our faith to do something about it, right? And not just be a bystander and also not be afraid of anything, right? We're only afraid of God. And so that's why I think I'm fearless. I get a lot of that from my faith. And no matter how big these politicians are, and, you know, there should be no fear in our hearts if we're doing it for justice and for the right, with the right intentions and the right reasons. And I hope that if I win, that I can make our democracy really accessible to more people, not just like me, but just more working people, working class people different than me as well. You know, we need to get more nurses up there, more waitresses up there, you know, more teachers, more immigrants. I mean, I think part of the reason that happens, Shireen and Anna, is because it's purposeful. I think it's intentional that government doesn't look like us, because then our government won't create the policies that really benefit us, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. That's a big problem. Yeah. It's a lot of the white rich men who are in charge have never had to live their lives like the people they're trying to help, or, you know, in quotes, help, they're supposed to help. They've never had to experience, you know, most of them, the majority of them, have never lived in poverty. They've never had to fight for work. They've never had to, you know, decide, am I going to be able to go to work or do I need to stay home and take care of my kid? Like, they've never had to make these choices that a person who's on the street, any regular person, has ever had to struggle with. And that's we need that change. And we need people like you. We need teachers, nurses, anyone who's willing, you know, even like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was a bartender. She's literally worked her way to the top. Like, she wasn't just like, hey, you know, your last name is whatever, Kennedy as an example.
Yeah.
Bush.
Yeah.
Hey, here you go. Here's the door wide open for you. Yeah. And I think that's really important. Like, real life experiences.
Yeah, Anna, you know what I think about is, there was one summer my students and I actually went to advocate for education in Congress and in the White House. And one of my students went with me in Trump's White House. We were in the Office of Science and Technology. And that was very powerful for me. I was obviously a teacher back then. But I remember there was mostly, you know, students of privilege there, not many students of color. And here was my student, I don't want to share her name, you know, to protect her privacy, but, you know, single parent home, first generation college student, president of my robotics team, a woman, you know, and a Latina, you know, teenager at the time, now she's in college, but sharing her story about how the lack of programs or having programs like robotics and after school programs have benefited her. And she shared it so eloquently, and she didn't hold back with her life and with how much these programs are needed in communities like Watts. And in that moment, just to your point, Anna, I knew like one day she's going to be a leader, and I want people like her to be in the White House, and I want people like her to be in Congress. And even then, I wasn't thinking of myself running, but I said, I need to run for my student here. I need, because I see her, and right now, looking around me, there's no one like her with her background that's in these places of power. And I want to create a system, you know, and at that time I was doing it as a teacher, but I said I wanted to create a system where I can increase access and break these barriers so she could be here one day and lead, you know, from her, with her own experiences, you know?
Yeah.
I think the essential thing about these leaders, like, and I think what you said is a really good point about making our government look like us. Mm-hmm. Right now, it doesn't look like us at all. No. Us being people of color, marginalized communities. What's common about all of these amazing leaders, these women of color, whether it's AOC or Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib, I always say her last name wrong.
Tlaib.
But what's common about all of them is that they're leading because they have a fire within them that, like, they have to. And a lot of other people that come into politics and come into power through family or through money, it's this lazy thing. It's this, it's not this passionate need for change. They're just filling in the status quo because that's what they do. But I want to get into your background a little bit more. So let's get into where you're from and your family history, your ethnicity, and your personal story that kind of led you to where you are today. So
you know, I'll start with the fact that I'm multicultural, because that's I think a big reason I'm running. It's really the lived experiences I've had. Of course, being a teacher in Watts is kind of what pushed me to really run. But I was born in Dubai. I was actually born in the Middle East and lived there for the first 7 years of my life. And my family fled the Gulf War, you know, right before it happened. And my dad had a great job and everything, but we didn't want to, my parents didn't want to raise their kids in a place where it could be potentially be dangerous. And so we moved to Canada.
And where are your parents from?
Sri Lanka. Yeah. So I'm Sri Lankan by heritage. I only lived there about 8 months though. And so, yeah, in Canada, I actually lived in the first province that had, you know, healthcare for all, which is Saskatchewan. Canada has healthcare for all, but it started at the provincial level. So I say this because, you know, in reflection, these experiences are part of the reason I'm so passionate about these progressive causes. When I lived in Canada, I never heard about anyone talk about healthcare because it was just a given. And so it was really impactful. I immigrated to the U.S. When I started high school here and college. And, you know, what was also really impactful is I was like 40 minutes from the location when 9/11 happened. And so I was, at the spot where life changed for Muslims, life changed for Americans, everything changed. And then in 2009, married my wonderful husband and moved out to L.A. The most pivotal experience was really working as a teacher in Watts. Growing up South Asian, education, you know, Sri Lanka is known to be the most literate area in South Asia. You know, we have a really high literacy rate. Education's really valued. And I always saw that as something that, like, oh, like, we work hard and we're fine. But then, you know, it's about how hard we work. But working in Watts, I saw how hard my students worked. I saw how hard the community worked. And I saw how much they were given and how many roadblocks, you know, were there. And I started working there, you know, when Bernie Sanders started his first run for office. And I really saw, you know, the things he talked about, the inequality, I really saw. And then when Trump got elected, that was such a difficult time for my students. I remember forefront of their mind was a lot of my undocumented students were worried that their families were going to be separated. They were in tears for weeks. That really affects you as a teacher because it's not something you're seeing on the news. It's something that you are hearing from your students. I had students that were homeless. I had students in foster care. And I, you know, really got involved in their lives. I, you know, a lot of them lived in the projects. I went to their homes and I visited them and knew their families. I drove them to their college interviews. And so I got really invested in the community. I started the first robotics team there. And then during this process of falling in love with the community, I also noticed a lot of things that were wrong, like the things I mentioned. But other things I noticed were that we didn't have access to clean water in our school and in many areas of Watts. I also got to know that, you know, a lot of the sites were toxic. The football team couldn't practice on the field because of arsenic and lead toxicity.
Oh, wow.
The projects where a lot of the kids lived on was built on top of an old steel factory. There was just a lot of toxicity. It's really environmental racism, right? That's happening because Watts is largely Latino and Black. And I naturally got more involved in the community. I was like, what's going on? What are the residents doing about this? What groups are organizing? And in that, I was in a group called Watts Rising. And it was basically a city grant to make Watts more healthy, bring clean air to Watts, bring sustainable housing. I went there really hopeful, but what I actually learned from it was the distrust that the community members who have been organizing for decades really had with these elected officials. And then, you know, I wanted to do more. So I actually applied to be a commissioner for my current opponent. It was very brief, though. I was a commissioner there because I found myself very quiet in that space and I'm naturally not a quiet person, but the reason was it was more of a position to kind of amplify him and do our work in our community and not really question. And to me, that's not what a good representative is. It's about being able to have community leaders and members question you. And that wasn't the place for that. And in doing work with Food and Water Action, an environmental group, I got to know his record more on the environment and a lot of issues. And it literally, I remember the moment I was in my living room, you know, pre-COVID, my son was in school, my husband was at work, and I just had tears in my eyes because knowing the experiences of my students and the community I worked in, I live in the district as well. I live close to refineries. Andres Guardado was shot 10 minutes from my house, right? So these issues aren't foreign to me either. And I saw that he really didn't have any progressive running against him. I mean, this district is very blue, and I knew I needed to challenge him. Sounds kind of crazy because this public school teacher is challenging him. But you know what? That's what we need to do. Mm-hmm. We need to not be afraid to step up and not be afraid of an entrenched incumbent. If he is not doing the job he was paid to do and elected, he's being paid to do, honestly, right. Our taxpayer money, right, yeah. is being paid and elected to do, then he needs to go.
Yeah.
You know, it's as simple as that to me. And so that's why I'm running.
Yeah. They're literally public servants, and it's never really about, it's rarely about public service. But we're going to take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back. We have so much more to talk about. Don't go anywhere. Back, your story is so pivotal because you know your community so well and you know exactly what you need to change it. And I think something that really I'm still thinking about is when you were in Canada, no one talked about healthcare because it was a given. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that is so essential to realize, to know that healthcare can be we can have healthcare and it can be a given. Like that's already, like, if Canada is an example for that, amazing. But the things that we keep talking about don't have to be this way. That's the thing that mm-hmm. I think I need people to realize is mm-hmm. we don't have to have it this hard. It shouldn't be this hard.
Right.
Also, very proud of you for running after it sounds like you were made into like a token, maybe woman of color for the person you're running against mm-hmm. because it probably made him look good to have you on his team, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And better off to fucking branch out and actually be the progressive in this battle. So
so you said you were kind of near where 9/11 happened. Did you guys move to the East Coast when you came from Canada?
Yes, so we initially immigrated to New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
So that's where I went to college, and yeah, high school and college. Mm-hmm.
And how was living, like, growing up in New Jersey after coming from Canada?
You know, it's interesting. It was actually different. You know, Canada has its history with Indigenous people. I don't want to, you know, discount that because
I know
it's just as bad.
Yeah.
If not, you know, I mean, just as bad. Yeah. I mean, so that's something that Canada still has to grapple with. Mm-hmm. But like we mentioned, healthcare. I also think current race relations is not as bad in Canada. The situation with police is not as bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, so immediately the difference, Anna, is that I felt race relations. I felt the color of my skin. I felt that people in the East Coast, there was a lot of Puerto Ricans. I felt that they were treated different. I started seeing things in the news about police brutality, and that was different as well. Mm-hmm. And I quickly learned that America has this awful history with Black and brown people. That's, in my mind, even stronger and even worse than what it is in Canada. And that's how it was different. And I think after 9/11, it changed a lot for Muslims as well.
And were you covering your hair back then around 9/11?
I wasn't, but my mom was. And I remember I was in college when that awful day happened. And it could have been worse for me. But I mean, the most, I had a Quran thrown at me. I had, you know, I had things written on, you know, outside of our dorm on our whiteboard. But it wasn't as too bad. I mean, as many people have experienced. But my mom wore hijab, and I know she had stuff written on her car. Mm-hmm. I mean, just, you know, she was spit on, and definitely she was more identifiable back then as a Muslim. It breaks your heart. Yeah, it broke my heart.
Anna and I were both in middle school during 9/11 or post 9/11, and my mom was covering her hair at the time, and I remember being so terrified for her just going to the mall. Like, I remember that feeling of being like, please don't leave the house. Like, I don't.
Yeah.
I'm so scared for you, for my whole family. Like, I got called racial slurs. I got bullied. And again, it's sad to say that was, I had it okay. You know what I mean? Like, it's sad that like your childhood trauma needs to be measured in that way. Or like your encounters with racism, you have to be like, well, it wasn't that bad, because it's still racism. It's still very traumatic to live through. And
yeah.
What was your journey to wearing the hijab? Because before we started recording, you were talking about how much you love the hijab. Mm. And I think it's very important for people to realize that it's not a symbol of oppression. I think a lot of white people have that wrong.
Yeah.
So what was your journey after not being covered to deciding to cover your hair and to be more obviously, quote unquote, Muslim? Like, obviously, in quote, not Muslim in quotes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think part of it was what America became after 9/11. And Muslims, I think, had different reactions. And I'm not here to judge anyone's journey. But my reaction was, you know, I'm very rebellious by nature, and I wanted to be known as a Muslim. I wanted to be identified as a Muslim. And I think the hijab made me instantly identifiable as a Muslim. And I think I wanted to do that because part of my reason was, look, Muslims are good people. Let me wear my hijab. This is one reason. I'm going to tell you another reason. Muslims are good people. If I wear my hijab and I'm Muslim and I can do good things in my community, I can maybe help, you know, the Muslim community in my little way. Part of it was also my journey in faith. You know, I was born Muslim. Sri Lanka is actually not majority Muslim. It's actually a majority Buddhist country. And so I have a lot of respect for the Buddhist philosophy. It's actually the smallest minority there is Muslim. And so, but I was raised Muslim, and I think a lot of us raised Muslim, or in any religion we're born into, it's very ritualistic. You know, our parents tell us to read the Quran and do these things, and it's like, okay, like, I don't know why I'm doing this. I don't know the meaning of what I'm saying all the time. And I kind of, you know, for that reason got disillusioned with it. I didn't fast. I didn't pray. This was more in like my, a little bit going into my college years when I went away from home. And my mom knew. I was very open with my parents about it. My mom is more religious, and you know, bless her soul, she never made me feel bad about it. She would just ask me, like, oh, are you going to fast? And like, you know, so she would know. But that part was kind of hard, because when I was like with the MSA and stuff, because I was still like community-wise with Muslims, and I felt kind of guilty about it. I'm like, okay, look, I'm not fasting in Ramadan and things, but I never wanted to do something I didn't believe in. That was always a part of me. If I do something, it's like, I believe in it. I think what happened was just some pivotal moments in my life that made me kind of believe in God again. A big part of that was like, I don't know. Now it's been so many years, but I know it's somehow I came back to it. One thing I can say, it wasn't my parents. It wasn't anything. It was me, you know, coming back to the faith. And another part of it for me was it's weird. It was more like a feminist expression, because I got sick of the sexualization of women. And I'm going to say this very carefully, because as someone who wears hijab, I believe in every woman's right to wear what she wants, be who she wants. It's not about that, but I think it's also my rebellious nature around almost, you know, look what's happening with the Me Too movement, what's happening with how women are still disrespected, with how I'm told as a women leader, I can't, you know, show my emotion because, you know, you're not taking to be a good leader. It was kind of my reaction to that too, and saying that I'm going to wear my hijab and I only want to be seen for my mind and my heart. And it was a symbol of that. That's why I did it.
I mean, it's interesting to hear that, unlike what everyone else assumes, you wearing your hijab was your own act of rebellion in a way.
Right.
And I think it's beautiful. I think it's so beautiful. I think it can really relate to your struggle with religion. I mean, I was raised Muslim, and we talked about this before we recorded, but religion is a very personal thing. And I think we have to really remember that when we have children that we're raising, or that when we come into our own faith, it's really a personal journey. And I like the idea of not shying away from what scares people. And like, for you, you really embrace, like, your rebellious nature is like so beautifully represented by the fact that you like went to the hijab. And I think it's a story that people aren't like, they don't hear that about hijabs or Muslim women or whatever. So, I don't know. I just think that you're a really good example of like a modern, and I use modern carefully because I'm not trying to say traditional is a bad way to be a Muslim, but like this, a new type of Muslim woman, new as far as the American culture is concerned, not new for us. You're a representative of a new reign of the marginalized community. And I'm really excited to see like where that takes you.
You know, Shireen, I'll say one thing. I actually think that this range of Muslims and Muslim women has always existed since the beginning of time, even when the Prophet was there. You know, I really do. I just think that is that there's not, it's hard to really live our truth, right, in the open. And I think, you know, I think that's what we need more of. I think we need to create a society and give women and give, you know, anyone who's a minority or marginalized the accessibility and the confidence they need to express themselves.
Yeah.
That's what it is, you know, and I think I might have that in my personal trait naturally, but I want to just say for anyone that's listening and to just be, you know, it's hard, but to encourage everyone to be themselves, even in spaces, right? Because we have those in our Muslim community who are very traditional and conservative. You know, we all have those uncles and aunties, and we have to speak about the homophobia in the Muslim community is big. And that's also part of the reason I'm running, is I want people to know that it's okay to be yourself, you know, no matter what that self is. And in fact, that is, I don't know, that's the only way to live, in my opinion. And I hope that we can be that accepting as a community, as a society.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's very interesting to me, because I've always seen, I mean, based off years of by my parents being told I have to go to like Quran study and stuff with my mom. Right, my mom still does it every Friday, right on time. Now it's on Google Hangouts, but she's still going strong. And I've sat in on a lot of them growing up, because when I was younger, I would just have to go with her. And so much of like in the study of the Quran is of like accepting others and like always having compassion and always looking to help and not take. And you know, my parents have come a long way. My mom is a devout Muslim, but my dad has he's become more secular over the years, just as he's lived in America. But like seeing their relationship with like the LGBTQIA plus like community, like they've come such a long way, but it didn't start that way. And I always thought that was very interesting of like culturally they had this kind of old-timey view of what it was to be gay. And then I remember always having these conversations with my mom of like, but isn't that what Islam is, of like it just accepting and not being here to like judge people?
Yeah.
And so much of that conversation, I mean, she's come such a long way and I'm very proud of her. And of course, you know, living in America and living in like kind of very progressive bubbles has helped that, and like having, you know, friends and working and being in this country since the 70s. But like, it's so fascinating how it's this stereotype of what Islam is, you know, of like, oh, if you're covered, you're wearing a hijab, a niqab, anything, a chador, like you're oppressed. And it's like, I always, there's this kind of joy I get in looking at photos of the Middle East in the 70s, like, or even like the 60s of like pre-Iranian revolution, where you're seeing like all these people and they just look like any other person from the 70s or 60s, just like, you know, dressed like that style, the 60s, 70s style. And it's like, guess what? Those are Muslims. They just were who they were at the time. Like there was no, there was no like preconceived notion of what Islam was. But then, you know, America, as soon as America grabs it, they're like, this is what it is. And this is how you have to see it. And that's so tough for me. Cause it's like, a person who's Muslim isn't a certain way. There's so many layers. Yeah. There's so many different types of people. Like you could look at me and be like, you were raised Muslim. Like, yes, I was. I was raised Muslim. I have read the Quran, but like, yes, I also watch a whole lot of trash reality TV. Like we're so, everyone's different. And I think, gotta love reality TV.
I mean, I really relate to Anna with like, my parents have also come back to the sexuality talk.
Yeah.
They've come a long way and I'm still very frustrated with the rhetoric that some of my extended family uses when it comes to sexuality or even racism. It's a very touchy subject for me because I'm viewed as like this, like you're too far the other way, like it's a joke, whatever. But to be very blunt, a huge reason why I stopped believing in God when I was younger is because I realized I was queer when I was about 12 or like a little bit younger than that. And I didn't feel like I was Muslim enough. I felt very ashamed. And I told my mom I didn't believe in God. She started crying. And I never spoke about it for a very long time because I didn't feel like I was Muslim enough. And I felt very ashamed about that. And it was because you're made to feel like a freak if you're if you question your sexuality or if you question your body. And I was a very confused child when it came to sexuality, when it came to being okay being a woman in my body. And so I really love that your platform is about the inclusivity, because mm-hmm. if I had seen a leader like that, I wouldn't have mm-hmm. felt so ashamed of myself. And I really want you to know how valuable that is. Like I that was a huge moment for me when I was a kid. Like I can like start crying about it, but I was just like, I don't know. And Anna's right. Like the Quran is about inclusivity. Like my entire family is Muslim. We went to Saturday school. I still have so many verses of the Quran memorized, like in my brain. Right. Like they'll just like reverberate forever because that's how I was raised, and they're beautiful to me. But I rejected it because it wasn't mine. It didn't feel like it was mine. Yeah. So I think it's important, regardless of what religion you are, to promote this general feeling of love and inclusivity, because it has impacts. Like, it really does. And yeah. I'm imagining, like, if I'm a kid being raised now and I see Fatima, like this assemblywoman or like person in the legislature, like who has a name of my family member who also tells me like it's okay that you exist.
Yeah,
that is pivotal. Yeah. That is so important, and I just really, really value that about your platform, because you've really seen, based on your work in the community and just based on yourself being a good person, like I think you know what needs to be addressed, and mm-hmm. Maybe I'm looking at it more as like a humanistic level, but I just can't help it because I'm like a sap, but it does make a difference. And so I really value that about your platform in general.
Thank you. Shireen, you are Muslim enough. And I want to say that I would like give you a hug, like if I could. And my parents also similar, probably to both of you, like grew more accepting. I just think, you know, we're going to, as a leader, when we say this in the open, there's going to be people that are going to be like, oh, I suffer a lot, right? Why are you saying that? I don't deserve to be in this position if I can't be honest about how I feel, mm-hmm. right? I can, you know, and I think, to be honest with you, like I'm Muslim and my husband and I have had tough conversations about the view of Islam towards the LGBTQ community. And in my opinion, you know, and my husband probably still disagrees with me, I truly feel like that God is loving and that God loves everyone. I really believe that. I think people are born the way they are, and that's God's creation. And so God does love everyone. I don't mean to sound cliche, but it's as simple as that to me. And we choose as people to hate certain groups of people. And I think that's a social mm-hmm. socialization of how we're raised, to hate people, to think people are different. I don't think that that's what God is, and that's what God wants, and that's how he created the world. I really don't. I want to keep saying that because I think we need more Muslim leaders. We need to not be afraid to say this. Mm-hmm. I've met some Muslim leaders when I've talked, you know, I'm never going to name any names, who are like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to say this publicly. This is how I feel, though. Mm. And I'm like, well, how are we going to change anything?
Yeah, they play it safe. They're trying to just be the model minority.
Model minority, yeah. But I don't think that's how we're going to change the world together as a society. We need to be open about this and talk about it. And I think it's what, to me, it's about justice and equity. And it's what it is about with the LGBTQ community too. Like, we have to be accepting. I don't want it to be hush-hush when I go to these parties and aunties talk about it. I hate that. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's part of the reason I'm running. It might be it's many things I'm running, but that's part of the rebel in me too, is to be like, no, like you're going to be hush-hush, but I'm going to be loud about it, and let's see what's going to happen. Yeah.
And I think for a lot of young Muslims, like for me, my response to religion was to reject it completely. Like I was really mad with God. I was mad about religion. Yeah. I didn't want anything to do with religion. And I wouldn't say I'm a believer, but before we recorded, I also mentioned that, and I've said this on a podcast before, but being Muslim is a culture the same way a lot of religions are like cultures. And I want to be proud to say I'm Muslim, but it's my own version of that, you know, because for me, the Muslim faith is like part of me. It's not something I can, like, I get moved when I hear the call to prayer. I can't explain it. It's just beautiful. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But at the same time, I wouldn't be comfortable praying still. What I'm trying to say is that I like the idea of reclaiming that word, being Muslim or Islam or the Quran, reclaiming that and however you see fit, because I can't deny, like, when I look at you, I still feel like you're my family, regardless if I'm not a believer or not. And I think that's really valuable, especially because I knew how much I hated religion, and I still know part of me kind of hates it. So, and that's just my own fucking trauma that I have to deal with. And I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that. But that message of inclusivity is so important, and the message of how you're speaking about it openly and not being hush-hush. It's, I feel like it's against a lot of immigrant cultures. A lot of immigrant cultures are like, let's keep this to ourselves.
It's very you know, be careful, your reputation. What would someone think about you?
Let's not talk about it. Let's just avoid the issue and let's not like talk about it. And I think that's very dangerous. I think that if you don't say how you feel, what side are you really on, right? And I'm not you quoting it, right? There's a great quote that I, that's not coming to mind right now, but it's like, I want, it's something like saying that if you don't stand against oppression, you're on the side of the oppressor, right? If you don't say something, that's still on the side of the oppressor. I truly feel that way.
Especially now, we're seeing it play out tenfold, you know?
Yeah.
Like, let's take one more break and we'll be right back.
And we're back. Fatima, you were going to say something.
Yes. So thank you for sharing that, Sharon. We need your story too. We need your story to be amplified. And I think what came to mind was actually, you know, what's in our scripture that says there's no compulsion in religion. And I think we forget that as Muslims. We judge and we put our own social beliefs in into people. But regardless of what you believe, like I think, I honestly feel like our job as Muslims, if you even do walk, you know, want to walk the walk of being a Muslim, is to not judge and put your judgment on other people's lives and let them live their lives. That's what our religion says, right? Your life is, you know, again, I'm not quoting this right from the Quran, but your life is yours, my life is mine. And I don't think we do that as Muslims. We judge and we get into other people's business. And I think that is actually what our faith doesn't teach us. So we need to remember there's no compulsion in religion. We need, and you know, Shane, your journey in Islam is beautiful to me because it is your journey.
Yeah.
That's why it's beautiful. You know what I mean? Like it, I think any journey that's not authentic and not lived the way you're living it is something that's forced. And so you are your heart is open and you're living your journey as a Muslim. And I think that's beautiful. Oh, not as Muslim, but as yourself, you know, in Islam.
No, I mean, and I think, I think your example should be played out in every religion. Like I mean, the majority of our leaders today, they tout that they're these like loving Christians. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. Totally against what their Christianity stands for.
Right.
So I think oftentimes it's the marginalized communities that take it upon themselves to reform when the powers that be are not taking that same energy or that same effort. So I think leading by example is the best way to do it. But those effects are prominent in most of the popular religions nowadays, you know, or most popular faiths. So
Shireen, I just wanted to add one thing. I mean, it's not easy, honestly, like even saying what I'm saying, like even when I say it, I'm getting like nervous. Like it's hard to like say it when I know it's going to the public, but I'm doing it because I know it's the right thing. I know right now saying this, there could be Muslim donors listening that aren't going to donate to me, but that's okay. Because I really believe like the world is generally good. And I really believe that the world generally agrees with us. And I think those few people that don't, it's like, you know what? Like, to me, that's like, I don't know the word
you'll,
for it.
You'll
but
magnetize it's like, the people towards you.
Right, that matter. Yeah. That's why I'm being brave and that's why I'm saying it. And because it's what I believe. Why should I hold back? And that's like not how we're going to change the world, you know?
And while some more conservative Muslims won't, whatever, can't, you know, I doubt any of those really listen to this show. I feel like we've pushed them all away with our own openness. But I think people who aren't used to seeing a Muslim woman being so open. And I mean, that's why we started our show, to be like, hey, you know what? We're all different and we all have our own way of life. And I feel like it's people who aren't used to it, people who just need to like break out of their comfort zone or their bubbles will be more drawn to you because they'll be like, wait, this person who doesn't look like me is saying something I agree with, which is like a big thing in this. Like, I feel like we're at such a turning point of like people being like truly understanding that, you know, like stereotypes are stereotypes. And, you know, you don't know someone until you've actually interacted with them and gotten to know them. Like, that's when you truly know someone. You can't just look at someone and be like, I don't know. I don't think she, because she's wearing a hijab, will get what I want out of life. And it's like, well, you don't know that. You don't know anything, you know? And just because you take a look at someone and you go, I don't know. they're Middle Eastern. They'll have more old-timey ideas. I always say old-timey, but what I'm going to say is like more just culturally conservative ideas of how things should be. And it's like, well, it's 2020. Like, yeah. We've all come
the word I think is regressive.
Regressive,
you know?
Yeah. Mm.
That's what I really think the word is. It's because it's not like, I think conservative is too light. Like, I think it's truly regressive. It's not.
It's
not bringing us forward in any way. So,
I do think we've all come a long way, though.
Yeah.
It's kind of impressive. And, you know, like, even myself, I want to say when I was like 15, I would not have understood how to have like respect when talking about a trans person. Like, myself have learned so much just by like listening and being like, mm-hmm. I don't understand that, but maybe I can try to understand it. And then now to think back, like, I would, you know, say terrible things too when I was younger, but all I had to do was just like listen and like read and like acknowledge that things were changing around me, and then I just also changed. We've all come such a long way, and I think like people who refuse to change, that's just not the people we want in our, you know, in our camp, if you will.
Yeah.
And one thing I want to also add is like, this is also, it's mentally traumatizing, I think, when you have someone in a community who's LGBTQ or who has anything that's, I guess, quote unquote, not the norm that, you know, regressive people, let's put it that, would accept, right? It's traumatizing. I want to just highlight the fact that people commit suicide, you know, when they are going through this in their community. And I think that's also why I want to say it, because if there's a Muslim youth, like a young brother or sister like listening right now, you know, that's why I'm doing it, because this does happen in the Muslim community. There's a lot of trauma. There's a lot of mental angst. There's a lot of, I mean, at the very least, at most, there could be, you know, youth who are suicidal. And this does happen. And I think that's why it's so important. And people that do not accept human beings the way they are should understand that they are contributing to these experiences of individuals that are feeling this way. And I think that's deeply damaging.
Yeah.
And so that's important too. It's you know.
I mean, I was that kid, you know, like, and the conversation of mental health and immigrant communities and marginalized communities, that's a completely different issue that is so important to us, because talking about mental struggles is kind of just like, just suck it up. Stop crying. All these
things.
That's
also taboo.
It's taboo.
Isn't it?
And so, talking about it and normalizing it. And again, like Anna and I, like, we started the show to normalize a lot of things that aren't normalized, and we're representing ourselves because no one else will. So it's like,
Shireen, you know, one thing is that like my son has autism. I've actually been told by my best friend, I'm not going to name her and out her, or like even in the beginning, sometimes my relatives, my parents, why do you talk about your son having autism? Like, you know, you're running for office. Why do you bring it up? Why do you, and I say I bring it up because why shouldn't I bring it up? You know, I mean, why shouldn't I, why, because we have this taboo against autism, kids who have autism, people that have autism, we have this, and I don't like flaunt it or anything like that, but it comes up when people ask me about my son, because it's a beautiful part of who he is, you know, and I don't want him to ever grow up in a world where he's ashamed of it or he feels ashamed of having it.
I love that. That's making mental health, emotional.
No, but I think mental health is the same way. Personally, I've learned to obviously be functional in society right now because of the privilege I had but I have generalized anxiety, you know, disorder as well. And that doesn't make me a less intelligent person or anything like that. You know, if you have the privilege of, you know, of getting therapy and doing things, you can learn how to deal with these things, right? But we need to, a lot of people have different mental health issues. It's on a spectrum. And I think we have to normalize it. And our leaders need to normalize it as well and not make it seem like, especially as women, especially as leaders, that it's something that makes us, you know, less capable or less functional, anything like that. And the way we make it less taboo is we talk about it, you know, and we bring it into these public spaces.
Yeah, I agree completely.
I agree. Yeah. And mental health, man, that's been, I mean, like, I have always suffered as like just a young, depressed kid who never felt like they fit in. I was very lucky that while my parents, like, I wouldn't say they're for therapy, but they let me go to therapy because I think they had hit a wall where they were like, we don't understand how to communicate with this, like, screaming, like, crying child who's, like, banging her head against a wall to, like, just express herself that they let me go to therapy. But there were like, I just always will never forget the day. First, you know, also we need more people of color in therapy, like therapists, mm-hmm. like psychiatrists, psychologists, yeah, because yeah. like it's hard. I remember always going to like white women and they yeah, were always yeah. like, I don't get it. Like, what do you mean your dad is so tough? Like they wouldn't, it was yeah. such a yeah. disconnect yeah. of me being like, no, you don't understand. Like my dad is a brick wall yeah. of a human being. Like, yeah. have you ever had mm-hmm. a, like an Iranian American father, like tell you no, yeah. like it's not great. But yeah. like, I remember yeah. like I had to bring my dad into the therapist, like literally one of my sessions, so she could interact with him and watch my dad be like, I don't know. She's so dramatic. All she does is cry. She's very weak. I can't deal with this. You fix her, you know? Isn't that what we're paying yeah. you? And then this woman is like, yeah. oh my God. Okay. Yes. Now I get it. And I'm like, see, like I need more people who know my experience. And I've always yeah. said like, we just yeah. need more people of color. Mm. We need more people who've experienced life in these sorts of positions mm. as well. Well, because like that's how young kids or even just younger adults are able to connect and feel seen and heard yeah. and we just need to like open this up so much more, because it's like we are America, like hate to yeah. sorry yeah. to make it like yeah. ours, we are yeah. America, but it's true yeah.
my mom and I talked about this the other day. Anna and I can relate to this, in the fact that like I was the sensitive kid. I was the emotional kid. They didn't know how to handle me. I was very mentally troubled, very depressed, but they didn't even know about therapy existing. When I was still a minor, they sent me straight to a psychiatrist because they didn't know what to do. Mm. And that took me on a whole journey of medication mm. that I'm still trying mm-hmm. to grapple with. But yeah. I didn't see a therapist for the first time literally until this year, earlier this year, because I was on this other journey of medication and psychiatry. And my mom told me on the phone the other day, like, she didn't know about therapy when I was 17. That wasn't even a thought in her mind. So I think normalizing these conversations is so important, because it not only makes those options visible, mm-hmm. but it makes them a real way for communities to cope. Because the same way that an eating disorder can be viewed as like a white girl problem, it's the same way, like, mental health is not a certain community's problem. It's a global, it's a humanitarian problem. It's a, so,
yes,
yeah.
yes. So. And I wanted to bring up, you're right, I had an eating disorder yeah, too. Me too. Like I was at, yeah, yeah.
It was a form of control for me. And honestly, not yeah, to trigger yeah. anything, but fasting yeah. for Ramadan made me really good at starving myself. And that mm-hmm. really fucked yeah. me yeah. up when I was in high school. And also made me question every reason that I was fasting. Yeah. But it was a version for me to control my life that I felt like I didn't have control over, because of having a yes. strict upbringing, having yes. a really strict yeah. father. Even now, like, I get nervous about posting a picture of myself in a tank top, even though, like, I don't.
It's,
you know,
traumatic
what I mean?
Going up this yeah. way. It's traumatic. No, it is. It's very traumatic. Yeah. I mean, because literally, Shireen and Anna, right? Our brains are developing till the time we're 18. So whatever we're taught and raised with, it does traumatize us during that time later in life. Like, I still, like, yeah. And I wanted to bring that up. I also wanted to, now that we're talking about, like, thank you to both of you. I know I'm like the guest, but I'm just so learning from both of you so much and your experiences. And this is such a beautiful show. Like, I love how open everyone is here. And, you know, one taboo I want to break too is, as a hijabi woman, is like, I also grew up being a really good athlete. Like, we don't really see that being amplified as a Muslim woman, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so now I do, you know, I do CrossFit, but I was state cross country champion in high school. I'm saying this not for myself, but I want other women, you know,
no, this is to, very valuable.
You know, just diversify. Yeah. Yeah. And also I had my 10K record. I ran distance in college for like over 10 years,
wow.
almost 13 years. So like I'm really proud of something, because I was known as a girl in tights. So, you know, growing up Muslim,
oh,
I wasn't
yeah.
Allowed
shorts
to wear shorts.
With tights all day.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Right. And if you know, like, okay, I'm just going to say this, the cross country world and the distance running world is a very white girl thing.
Uh-huh.
And I was in New Jersey. I was in the suburbs you know, so I was known as a girl in tights, like, to the media mm. and to everyone. I loved it. Like, I think that kind of was in my journey of like being like, yeah, like I like being different.
Yeah.
And I did really well, and I like beat everyone. So it was great, you know?
Yeah.
So it normalized it for, I think, a lot of people watching me run. But
I love that. Oh, you get cooler and cooler the more we talk to you.
And also, like, I deadlift 315 pounds.
Wow.
I clean 145, you know, like, I
Whoa.
Think it's important.
Holy
like
shit.
Especially as a hijab woman. No, but it's something I want women to I think being strong is so many things. It's being mentally strong. It's being the power to be yourself. It's being physically strong. Mm-hmm. It's a big part of me. That's why I wanted to share it, because I think it translates into me being, it's part of me being a rebel and part of me, like, I don't know, just being ourselves and not being afraid to be strong. I think it's just something so important. Like, I hope all women can be whatever way their strength is, you know, whatever way they want to show that.
Yeah. I really, I love that so much. I love that. I love that so much. I think our culture, I mean, I'm saying our as like an extended, like, South Asian, Middle Eastern, Muslim culture, but we don't value physical strength in women or physical fitness.
We
don't value that at all. And like, it wasn't until my mom was like in her midlife that she started hiking and being like, I love to hike. And I was like, I love it too. But like, we don't value strength. And I love that you have that element of you, because you're right. Like, we should value this, like, physical, not just, it's not even about being physically fit, but our body is all we've got. Mm-hmm. And there's this huge stereotype of like getting married and becoming like, especially in the Muslim community, you become a homemaker, you need to know how what to cook, all these other things. But like, seeing my mom evolve when she discovered physical activity and going to the gym, like, that was beautiful to me, because she was just like, I feel strong. Like, I feel strong for the first time.
Oh,
that's amazing. So it's, I love you so much. You're such a badass. I love it so much.
No, I love both of you too. I mean, your stories are inspiring, and I wish we were in person so we could give each other hugs you know, just be in each other's presence. That would be so nice.
I know. Hopefully one day. I do want to say also, I feel like I saw that pressure to like look a certain way. Like, you know, families are so blunt. Mm. They'll just be like, you're fat now. And you're like, what?
Yeah.
Like, why would you ever say that? But I feel like I also saw it in like the men in my family. Like, they also, like, there's just so much pressure. It's like, not, it's not even just on the women, it's also on the men. And it's like, we just have to like normalize being like open about our feelings. Like, my dad is like very obsessed with his weight. Like, he's always talking about his weight. Like, he's like, I don't know, do I look good? And I'm like, you're so interesting, because like, you're fine. You're also getting older. It's okay to look at, like, you're getting older. Like, there's no pressure on you. Like, you can just live, exist, eat what you want. And it's like, you don't need to feel this pressure either. And then you don't need to like basically put it on me as well. Like, we should all just exist and be free. And it's funny, because my mom at one point decided, like, I remember when I was like in high school, my mom told my dad to not comment on her looks anymore. And my mom, she's a devout Muslim, but she's very quiet. She's very pleasant. She's not an intense person until you like really annoy her. And then you see a side of her where you're like, oh, she can be scary. But I remember the day when she looked at my dad and said, if you ever say anything about my looks again, I will leave you. I will take everything and you will never see me again. And I was like, whoa, mom wouldn't really do that. But like, the way my dad was like, oh my God, like, it shook him to his core. Cause she's like, she doesn't speak like that. I must have really struck a chord. And he's truly, and I don't know what he did, but I guess he just internalized all that. And he only worries about his own looks now. But like, it was a very fascinating moment where I was like, wow, like, she really just put him in his place. And that was like a very, it's funny, cause I went away from Islam and I've really come back to it. Like, I wouldn't say I'm like a super practicing Muslim, but I'm very intrigued by it. Like, I will listen to what my mom says about her like Quran studies. I, you know, casually have looked back at the Quran, even though I have this weird thing about it. When I was a kid, I didn't know how to process it very well, and it scared me a lot. Like, it always felt too real. And I'm trying to like learn it again, of like, don't take it serious. Like, don't be like scared that God's going to like smite you or something if you do something wrong. But like, to see, like, I don't know, like, that kind of brought me back a little. It's like, my mom is a very strong woman. She might not be very like vocal, she might just be quiet and pleasant and not like say a lot, but she is probably one of the strongest women I've ever come in contact with. Yes, like my mom. But like, I've never seen someone truly like exist of like, I don't care what you think of me, I don't want to hear your opinions. I live my life how I live it. I'm a devout Muslim woman. She's also an electrical engineer. She's like one of the smartest people I've ever seen. Like she like hand draws schematics and will be like, this is a camera. And I'm like, what? How did you do that? And she's like, I'm an electrical engineer. And you're like, okay. Like to me, it's like, you're just mom to me. But like, she's so empowering to me. And it took me a long time to like come back to that and seeing her as like this Muslim woman and not just like, she's just a overbearing religious woman who's always telling me God is watching when I leave the house, which she still does. But now I don't like, you know, it doesn't hurt me as much of like, stop trying to control me because I've done enough therapy. Right. But like, she's so fascinating to me and there's so many layers and she's so tough. And it's like, you don't see that until you get to know her. And it's like a really beautiful thing to me. And that's like what brought me back to Islam is to like see this woman who is just like practicing, but then is also this like, I don't know. She's like this being. She's almost like glows to me now when I see her. I'm like, God, she's also very self-actualized, which is really cool. Like she's always like, don't worry about it. Like nothing, nothing can affect you.
I think you bring up a good point. Like my mom is my favorite person in the world, but I think you bring up a good point in that the Muslim women in our lives, the Muslim women who raised us, they kind of define this like beautiful strength that I think we only realize as we get older. Like I had the same experience. Like I was like, don't control me like when I was a kid. But my mom now is, especially as an adult, when you learn more about your parents and you see them as complete human beings, not just your parents. I am so obsessed with my mom. She's the strongest, most beautiful person I know. And her birthday's tomorrow, so I'm getting especially sappy. But tomorrow being, we're recording this on the 14th, so her birthday's on the 15th. But I think being raised by strong Muslim women, and my mom, she doesn't pray anymore, but she treated her prayer as meditation. And she was, it was the first time I really saw, because I was also very afraid of religion growing up. I would like say surah every night before I went to bed and pray to God that my family would be safe and they would live long lives. Like I had this whole recitation memorized in my head. I said three surah and then I would say, please protect my family. I want them to live long lives. I want, like no sickness or whatever. And every night, because someone in the mosque told me that if a shoe is faced upright, because you don't wear shoes inside, so all our shoes were in the garage, but if a shoe's bottom, if the shoe's sole is facing the ceiling, it's an insult to God. And I was afraid that if we were insulting him, he would hurt my family. So I would go down to the garage like in the middle of the night multiple times to make sure all the shoes were turned right side up so he wasn't facing the sky. So that fear of religion. And I mean, I'm just bringing this up because I relate so much to what Anna was saying. But to bring it back, I think having strong Muslim women, not just in our lives, but also physically visible as leaders is so essential to not just Muslim people, to everybody, to know that this is what a leader can look like. Like, this is what a leader needs to look like to reflect the needs of her community. And yeah, I'm just really excited to see your platform evolve. And I'm really excited for you to be the first Muslim in California legislature. Like that's a huge thing. So where can people learn more about your platform, about what you're doing? How can they get involved, especially if they're living in LA?
Yeah. So to learn more, my website is fatimaforassembly.com. And, you know, I'm on social media, that, you know, Fatima for Assembly on Twitter, it's the number four, but you could learn about my platform there and more about my, even like, you know, we learned a lot about my journey, but like even more about my journey there. Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe in a couple of weeks, you'll have to come back and we can like get into depth about your policies and everything, because there's so much more to this. And I really encourage you, if you're in LA and your district is what number?
Is District 64.
I was going to say that, but I wasn't sure. So if you're in District 64, please, I mean, like, I don't know what the probability is, like how many listeners we'll have from that district in particular, but if you know people living in LA, if you know people living in 64, just let them know about Fatima. She is the fucking future and we need her. We all need her.
Oh. But I have to say, even if you don't live anywhere in this area, you can still donate to her campaign.
I was gonna say, Anna, I was like, honestly, funny story. My district, a lot of it went to Bernie.
Yeah.
And then when I tried to pull a list, I was like, oh, let me see, you know, if anyone here donated, I could ask them to donate to me. It was like seven or eight people because my district is so poor. So, you know, it it's only like less than 5% people that donate. So yes, please. I forgot to plug that in. Thank you, Anna. Like, please go to my website and do donate. Every dollar helps, because I'm a clean candidate, not taking any police money. And, you know, I'm running against a former cop, and he's gotten like $150,000 of police money too. So please donate. Even if it's like $5, $10, it always goes a long way. So
yeah. And we'll put the donation links in
the description,
show notes, in our footnotes.
Yay. Thank you.
Because Anna's right. You can be anywhere. You can still donate a couple of dollars. Yeah. And I think it's very important to remind everyone that you're running against not only a former cop, but someone that's taking a lot of money from institutions that need to be reformed. Yeah. And being a grassroots candidate is really telling of the needs of the community. And thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This was so, I don't know. It was like a therapy session for me, but but I'm just really honored that you are such an open book and that you're willing to share your story with everybody and that you're running, because I really do believe that we need you. And I'm excited to be in a city that can like have your influence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. It's like such an honor to be here. And you know, I need all of you too, you know, so I think like we all need each other, you know. This is like a movement. I think, you know, me getting elected, but also like you doing media and amplifying stories is so important. And I think making, you know, just every part of us, people on the streets protesting right now, right? All the frontline workers, we're all essential. We're all important to the story of justice. Yeah. And so let's all, you know, I want to say inshallah. That's what God means, God willing, inshallah, create a world where we can all have justice, live our lives the way we want to live our lives, and just have a world that's more loving and compassionate and accepting, you know. So
I agree.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thank you for having me, Anna and Shireen.
Thank you for doing the show.
Yeah. I'm just going to wrap us out then.
Okay.
This is Ethnically Ambiguous. It's Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I'm Shireen. It's Shirohiro on Instagram and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm at Anna Hosni on Twitter.
And please follow Fatima for Assembly. It's Fatima, the number 4, Assembly. And donate. Links in the notes. Yeah. Thank you so much again.
Yeah.
Seriously, everybody, pay attention to this campaign and please share it and donate if you can. And
volunteer too.
Volunteer, yes.
Yeah, there's volunteering on my website too. So phone banking and, you know, all that stuff. So
perfect. And until next time, too. Just
donate.
Donate.
Yeah. You guys are pushing it more than I
We want to.
It's very expensive in California politics. Mm-hmm. Like, it's ridiculous. Okay, so just really quick, like, I know Canada's running in other states, like Rhode Island and Delaware. Mm-hmm. There's no like Silicon Valley and all these like wealthy. California is like really like a lot of money in it. And it's bad for candidates like me, but it's good for like corporate politicians. Mm-hmm. But like other races are so much cheaper. Like it's smaller district. It's like, yeah, but not trying to complain. Hey, alhamdulillah, I have a home. I have a good family. But definitely that part of being a candidate is a struggle. But thank you for amplifying. And all right, I got to run now, but I hope we can do this again.
Please.
Maybe like a part 2.
Yes.
And we could talk about like policies and stuff. But this was great too, because it lets people also know me. Like,
it humanizes the candidate.
Right.
It starts here, and then we will get you to Congress. We'll get you even further. That's where it starts.
Inshallah.
This is the beginning of an amazing journey. Inshallah. Thank you again. Have a great rest of your evening. We love you so much. Thank you.
Oh, I love you both too.
Thank you
so much for being so great.
Okay.
And have a good rest of your day. And know that, like, I love you. And, like, you know, and we're working for a world where everyone in the world loves you.
Yes.
Both of them. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.